From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. What follows will be an ominous look at an extremely familiar media institution. But first, buzzword time.
We have lots of talk about disruption this morning. Companies taking old-fashioned industries and shaking them up.
The digital era has disrupted the business of journalism, as many of you know.
One of the hottest startups disrupting the industry.
What I call digital disruption.
Nowadays, it means positive, radical change, which is swell if you're not the one being disrupted. For instance, what if you'd cornered the children's shoelaces market when Velcro came along? Or what if you were a symphony orchestra living off the subscriptions of rapidly aging and steadily expiring music lovers? What if you were a car maker and consumers wished to shop directly from the factory? You couldn't allow it because that would cut your current customers, the dealers you depend on, out of the deal. Or worse, what if the biggest dealers started selling brands of their own? Any of these scenarios could be ruinous. Put them all together and you have the existential threat variety pack. Technological, competitive, demographic, and internecine. And every last one of them applies to
You're listening to NPR.
Yes, the nation's largest producer and distributor of public media is being buffeted from all sides because the space it once monopolized is now packed with an ever-growing number of competitors that you probably think of as NPR, but which are not. Among them, PRI, American Public Media, PRX, and our host station, WNYC, which is an NPR member station, in fact, its biggest customer, but also a direct competitor pitching its own national programs, like this one, to other stations. Then there are the commercial podcasting companies like Gimlet, Slate Panoply, Midroll, and Audible, all creating rich, compelling, highly narrative content.
What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast.
From Slate, it's the gist.
This is Lexicon Valley.
Welcome to another round with Heaven and Tracy.
From Gimlet, this is Reply All.
Battling for the same sets of eardrums. As NYU journalism professor and new media thinker Clay Shirky observes, it's quite a tangle. I strongly advise you to grab a pencil and take notes. A flowchart would be good.
The obvious conflict is between the member stations, the KBIAs and WNYCs of the country. Those stations buy shows from NPR, collect money for those shows, pay the money back to NPR. NPR uses the money to produce the shows. And so there's a whole ecosystem there, which assumes that the only way NPR shows get into your ears is via these member stations. There is a problem with being in the middle there.
With him so far?
Then there's the conflict between the small member stations that don't produce their own shows and places like WNYC, which has some interest in having its audio products get out in the podcasting world as well as on terrestrial radio. So there's tension between the member stations as well. And then, of course, there's a whole host of other producers of radio and podcasts for whom the move to podcasting allows them to do something that would have been inconceivable 5 years ago, which is to compete with NPR on level turf. And that collection of bundled up, complicated relationships, it can never be untangled. It's the Gordian knot. Someone's just going to have to come along and cut it. And cutting this particular Gordian knot looks like saying, the podcasting thing is going to happen anyway. NPR might as well move into the future it knows is going to happen.
Right. The future is on demand. The audience awaits. All NPR has to do is serve it directly with its own podcasts and its own app called NPR One, an algorithmically curated on-demand streaming service. Except, like the previously mentioned automaker, NPR doesn't get its funds directly from consumers. It gets its money from its dealers, the roughly 950 member stations. And every listener to whom NPR serves a podcast is a listener who is not listening to those stations. This otherwise arcane conundrum leapt into public view last month when an NPR executive issued a memo forbidding the active hyping of podcasts and the NPR app on NPR's airwaves. The internet lit up in mockery, and Professor Shirky artfully plotted with Confederates to buy underwriting time on NPR shows to pitch NPR's own podcasts and its app to its own listeners.
I don't know if I will hear back from them, but I said very clearly, we would like to buy a sponsorship for Weekend Edition, and we would like to use it to promote NPR One.
At the beginning, it was so simple.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Robert Conley with All Things Considered.
Back in 1971, All Things Considered went on the air with a clear mission.
Genuine diversity of regions, values, and cultural and ethnic minorities, which comprise American society.
This is NPR's founding program director, Bill Siemering, reading that mission statement.
National Public Radio will not regard its audience as a market or in terms of its disposable income, but as curious, complex individuals who are looking for some understanding, meaning, and joy in the human experience.
That ideal was tested on NPR's very first day on the air, covering an anti-war protest in Washington, D.C.
This green and growing land, walk through the meadows and the mountains and the sand.
Then I was running through a parking lot and someone threw a club at me.
Threw a club at you?
Yeah, threw a club at me.
Sergeant, excuse me, Jeff Kamen, National Public Radio. Is that a technique where the men actually try to drive the bikes into the demonstrators?
No, it's no technique. We're trying to go down the road and the people get in front. What are you going to do? You don't stop on a dime.
45 years later, NPR is more sophisticated, more professional, more entertaining, more far-flung, and it offers vastly more things considered. But as it's evolved, has it also strayed? Siemering is in awe of the institution that's emerged from his original vision, but...
Initially, I envisioned that about a third of the program would come from stations, so we would have the country hearing itself, and that's never happened. I think the pressure of the news these days kind of crowded out that idea of let's hear America talking to itself.
The job is not to raise money or to make sure that people buy a product. The job is to educate and inform and make sure you're serving your communities.
Melody Joy Kramer is a digital strategist and former NPR journalist.
And if the people who are working in it aren't serving it, then we need to go back to the research table and say, like, how can we do better and how can we meet the needs of somebody who, you know, arrived in the United States not too long ago and is using public media to learn English, or somebody who is getting news snippets because they work a night shift. These are public media listeners too, and their voices might not be heard in the current discussions.
You know, our mission is to do things for the American public that the commercial media doesn't always do.
Scott Finn is the head of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
And we can lose our way if we think that our main job is to produce really, you know, super entertaining programs that get huge audiences. That's nice when that happens, but that's not what we were set up to do.
He points nervously to cable TV's attempts to produce educational content on the Learning Channel, the History Channel, and Discovery, all of which eventually succumbed to marketplace pressures to produce reality garbage.
There are whole television networks on cable that were founded with the idea that they could do what PBS does. And look at the Learning Channel today, you know, Honey Boo Boo, right? And they realize if they want to make money, they have to do a different type of programming.
But even if the audio slope is not so slippery and the mission creep is not so creepy, Finn represents a strain of thought among some stations that NPR's focus on growth, sellable demographics, and revenue has squandered its most valuable asset, the stations themselves, which not only aggregate the audience and pay the piper, but day in and day out represent the very diverse voices and issues and circumstances NPR was chartered to feature.
And this idea that's out there that stations are putting their claws into NPR and holding it back from its future is completely backwards. We're their competitive advantage.
That advantage played out with the recent trial and conviction of local coal baron Don Blankenship for conspiring to break mine safety rules that led to the deaths of his mine worker employees.
John, these family members are very vocal right now. They are not happy. Is there anything that you would like to say to them?
Well, just that their coal miners didn't cause the accident. That's all.
I hope you never have to bury your kid.
Obviously, are running high out here outside the courtroom.
We buried our kid because of you.
Not only did NPR not send a reporter down, they trusted us to cover it. When our reporter got this excellent tape of the family members yelling at Don Blankenship on the courthouse steps, NPR took what was going to be a low-down story in ATC and made it their top story of the hour.
Such grassroots coverage isn't routine, but also not a new development. The integration of stations in the news product has ebbed and flowed since creation. Likewise, many of these suddenly high-profile organizational conflicts and kinks are as old as Susan Stanberg's pension fund. On the other hand, there are kinks, and there's Shirky's Gordian knot. Not to get too self-referential about this, but just think about WNYC, which buys shows from NPR and sells shows to NPR stations. Plus, it buys from other suppliers than NPR, This American Life, for instance, and also makes and distributes podcasts on many platforms. Soon, it will be manufacturing industrial chemicals and driving your kids to school. It is everywhere. And it's also, according to WNYC President and CEO Laura Walker, entirely bullish about NPR.
I think this is what change looks like. When we have the opportunity together as local stations, national producers, as NPR and public radio in general to be even more important and impactful. Great national journalism, but tentacles and roots in communities around the country. So I think we are up to evolving and disrupting ourselves.
But as NPR meets its obligation to follow the audience wherever it's getting its audio, increasingly on smartphones, that has represented a threat to the stations. Is that a problem for which there is yet to be a solution?
NPR is actually really lucky because NPR gets fees from the stations. They get underwriting basically from the stations, and it gets grant money. That's a great model. And it doesn't have to be that the stations are going to hold NPR back. That, frankly, I think is a story that is a convenient story to tell. But I don't think that's where it's at. I think it's about creating the next level of what that national-local partnership means that actually strengthens the stations and strengthens the connection with their listeners because people want it. We know people want it.
What pisses you off about NPR? I mean, slow, glacial, bureaucratic, reactive, arrogant. I mean, what's on the list?
I'm sorry,
I can see you presidenting.
Yeah, you know.
I can see the the presidential rays are shooting out of you. I wish I were wearing a leaded apron.
No, I'm trying to be thoughtful about it. We all in public radio need to sound more like this country, be more like this country. And I think NPR honestly, truly is making such progress in the last several years in terms of being a journalistic and other partner to us.
I'm sorry. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but do I understand you as saying that it had begun to look more and more like its stereotype of urban coastal elites and white people with tote bags?
Not really. I mean, I think that every media organization in this country needs to be looking at itself deeply every day. Every day we at WNYC, we ask ourselves, if we were inventing public radio now, what would it look like? You know, every day. And every day we want to innovate in ways that are going to be responsive to this changing media environment, to this crazy world we're living in, and stick very close to our values. And I just want to do that in partnership with the smart people at NPR and our colleagues around the country. And if anything, we like to be ahead. We're New Yorkers. We believe deeply that people want to hear what New Yorkers think. So we're out there
innovating.
Well, we don't
want any part of your values.
But I think that we have this incredible opportunity to remake public radio.
NPR itself declined to speak with us about its plan or about anything else. But Laura Walker does make some salient points. The network's multiple sources of revenue, endowments, foundation grants, advertising, and individual donors via station programming fees are indeed the envy of the media industry, which has been decimated across the board by plummeting ad revenue. And while Morning Edition and All Things Considered have lost broadcast audience in chunks, they are making up some of the losses online. Furthermore, NPR News is not only the most robust and serious national broadcast news operation, it's almost the last one standing. The networks bring you headlines for 22 minutes a day. Cable news channels talk endlessly about the news, but they seldom really report any. Bill Siemering.
I think we need to pause a moment and just celebrate the incredible talent that is public radio today. It's just breathtaking.
Yes, but so are the challenges. The increasing obsolescence of broadcast transmission is not a trivial matter. And how NPR and its member stations adapt is anyone's guess. It's likely that at some point, All Things Considered and Morning Edition will cease to be the twin suns around which the rest of the system orbits. The current podcast boom could bust when venture capital runs out and its ad revenue, like everybody else's, fails to cover the nut. As for serving the underserved, consider a station like WXPR-FM of Rhinelander, Wisconsin. It, of course, plays Morning Edition and All Things Considered, but it also offers such local oddities as The Polka Show and Dream Farm Radio. For the near future, at least, it is not going to be smartphoned and podcasted into irrelevance. Because its listeners so cherish WXPR's content? Maybe. But also, they don't have Wi-Fi.
Or high-speed internet availability here in northern Wisconsin, as in other parts of the country.
Pete Rondello is WXPR's president and general manager.
The broadcast part of our signal is still very viable. So when do we turn the transmitters off? It might be 30 or 40 years from now, Bob.
But elsewhere in the NPR universe, the converging threats have an almost mythic quality. If not a Gordian knot, then a sword of Damocles dangling ever perilously above. Just remember that to get out from under, Damocles had to rethink how big and powerful he really needed to be.
The sword of Damocles is hanging over my head. And I've got the feeling someone's gotta be cutting the thread.
Coming up, free speech runs headlong into the refugee crisis in the heart of the European Union. This is On the Media.